Okay, we're off again. This is an interview with Gerald H. Gibbons, who was a petty officer in the Royal Canadian Air Force, ultimately a petty officer in the Royal Canadian Air Force.
Pilot officer.
Pilot officer, sorry. And the date is the 8th of November, 1988. First of all, Mr. Gibbons, if you could just tell us your date and place of birth.
Vancouver, May the 28th, 1916.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any relations involved with the Canadian Forces in the years entering up to Second World War, brothers or sisters or father or
any? None whatsoever.
Okay, no influences in that regard. This is a fairly standard question that I ask quite a few of the fellas, and because it's an interesting one, I think, to find out motivations. Why did you enlist in the Canadian Forces?
I didn't particularly want the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the basic living conditions generally would be better.
Mm-hmm. Coming out of a depression and...
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Almost something along the lines of full employment, a regular job almost.
Well, for that time, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What attracted you especially to the RCAF? Why the Air Force as opposed to, you say you didn't want the Army or the Navy?
Well, my personal friends had joined the Air Force. And they liked it. My time was up, coming close to being on the draft, so I joined the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. And what year would that be originally?
1942.
Which, by my math, would make you 26 years old at the time, mm-hmm. 25, 26. Yep. And for that time, particularly during those years when the average age was perhaps in the late teens, or early 20s, you would be
Getting on,
an old soldier right off the bat. Was there any romance attached to air? Was it strictly peers and the fact that your friends were... Okay. As you say, it was 1942 when you enlisted, June to be specific, and you were enlisted, designated rather, as an AC-2. And just briefly, what was an AC-2?
Well, it's the lowest rank. Every woman starts off basically at that.
Mm-hmm. And the AC standing for...
Aircraftman, second class.
Okay. You went initially to Edmonton, to what was called the Manning Depot, for approximately 6 weeks. Briefly, what was the Manning Depot? That would be what?
Well, basic training.
Mm-hmm.
Marching, discipline.
Mm-hmm. So not necessarily air training, but...
No, just ground.
Mm-hmm.
Learning to live in barracks with other men,
mm-hmm.
eating
mm-hmm.
communally and rather than privately.
Having, as you stated at the outset, no real background in the military, either yourself or your family, how did you find the adaptation to military life?
Fine, I didn't know discipline problem. I must say, to an extent, I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, wasn't that happy, but I did wasn't unhappy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a fairly neutral answer.
Yeah.
I like that. From Edmonton, you went to Calgary for approximately 6 weeks. To what you referred to earlier as tarmac duty, which is the first time I've come across that. What was that, essentially?
Just Joe Jobs, whatever the orderly officer or whatever wanted us to do.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were on guard duty. We were on the other tarmac, running messages. That's all I can really remember.
Was that a fairly standard procedure for all the fellows going through the air?
I understand at that time, anyway, because of the great influx into the personnel, and the air war over Europe was heating up.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting
mm-hmm.
more planes and mm-hmm. more crew are joining, and it was just a matter of.
Okay, we're back. We had a slight interruption there with the telephone. But we left, we were talking about the fact that tarmac duty, and that was a fairly common feature of training for Canadian air crew. It seems you were on a shuttle here between Calgary and Edmonton, because again, you go back to Edmonton for what was called initial training school for approximately three and a half or 4 months. And presumably initial training school is what the name suggests. You would be trained...
Schooling in mathematics and navigation,
mm-hmm.
Pilot training to an extent, mm-hmm. on a training... I forget the name of the thing now.
Yeah, there was a special machine set up for that purpose, right?
So at the end of the the course, then you were segregated into the basic trades, mm-hmm. pilot, navigator, air mm-hmm. gunner. Mostly the ones that failed were air gunners and bomb aimers.
And I suppose you would be separated based on results of how you did test-wise?
Test-wise,
right,
yeah.
Right, okay. In late 1942, as we say, that was approximately 4 months in Edmonton. Late 1942 was your actual first flight, November 42 to be specific. First of all, what type of aircraft were you on, and what was your impressions of that first flight?
It was an Anson in Edmonton, and it was a civilian pilot. Enjoyable, except for the more or less the takeoff. The port engine was a little, I thought, shaky, and smoke coming out of it, which I wasn't aware of. And
not exactly a confidence booster.
No, but apart from that, it's fine. Mm-hmm. You know.
Mm-hmm. You graduated from the ITS in March of 1943, whereupon you went presumably to Halifax on your way to Europe.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, as a man trained in air crew, I'm wondering what your impressions of the voyage to Europe were.
Well, it was a long haul, as mm-hmm, it were. Mm-hmm. We going across Canada on the train nearly a week. That wasn't so bad, except it seemed quite long. Then we were in Halifax hanging around for a good month to 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. Then we were shuttled off to Moncton for another 4 or 5 weeks. And then finally, about the middle of May, we went back to Halifax for a draft to England, getting there on May the 24th.
24th, right. This is something that seems to crop up again and again when talking to the veterans. There's a war on in Europe. Presumably, they need all the manpower, and yet there seems to be, particularly with the Canadians, a lot of delays and swanning about, going from one depot to another, finally getting to Halifax and waiting around. And then once you get to England, you're waiting some more. And I'm just wondering, why was that?
Well, they used the big ships, you know, the big Empress boats and the Queen Elizabeth, and they could only make so many crossings, mm-hmm. you know. It mm-hmm. made 4 or 5, and by the time they got there and turned around and came back, and perhaps another load, they didn't, I wasn't aware of them going in convoys. Mm-hmm. You're on your own, and the Empress boats could go much quicker,
sure.
much faster.
Sure.
I guess that's the only answer I would know of, except logistics.
Yeah, I just find it surprising, yeah. given the fact that there's a war, you would assume they would need all these fellows over there as quickly as possible. Yeah. And your experience doesn't seem to be unique. A lot of fellows sort of waited around from one depot.
Then you get to England, and there's more waiting.
Sure.
Hurry up and wait.
Mm-hmm. As you say,
as if there was no war on.
Right, right. As you say, you wound up in England, in Liverpool to be specific, on the 24th of May, 1943. You wind up in Bournemouth, which I believe is in the south of England, which I gather is where all the Canadians went initially. What were your impressions, although you were in Canada previous to this training for war, you get to England, you're actually technically in a war zone. What were your impressions of wartime England as you stepped off a boat?
Well, we weren't aware of it from Liverpool, except the last impression of everyone gets is just going row after row of homes, all belching smoke from the train. Never saw any really fighters or no air battles anyway.
No,
and
evidence of
bombing. Or, it's still, it didn't get going, the bomb offensive, until the late part of 43.
44.
They might have put up a few big raids, but they were few and far between.
Mm-hmm. As you say, initially you along with the rest of the Canadians in England basically did a lot of sitting around for a while. What about at this time? I assume you were undergoing training, some sort of training flights and whatnot, or was that?
Well, not for quite a while. Mm-hmm. Just Joe Jobs and attached to an army unit for a while, and army training just, I guess, for survival as much as anything, should anything happen.
Give you guys something to do.
Yeah. You know, and then finally in August, went up into a navigation school for a month.
And this would be in Scotland?
In Scotland, right. Yes.
Okay. And again, as you said, it would be primarily navigation, yes, map but, reading, that sort of thing.
The weather was so poor that only had about 8 flights during the whole month.
Is that right? So I assume at this time, this is an assumption, but one would think that the Canadians by now are really aching to get into action or do something.
Well,
and if not, why not?
Yeah, but we're a lot of the us were in the RAF at the time too. You know,
the RAF.
I think
right.
The RAF, if I'm not mistaken, in the observer school.
In October of 1943, after you complete the advanced navigation course, you go to an operational training unit at Doncaster until approximately November, which is roughly a month.
Yeah.
And it's here where you get
crewed up,
so to speak. And what is the process by which they crew men together? What are the criteria for?
Well, my experience that I remember was more or less a certain day. The pilots are told to choose their crews, and so the pilot came around. And whether I was the first chosen or the last, I'm not aware of at the moment, but. We got the crew together, and quite a good crew. I'm very happy with it.
Mm-hmm. And you were, despite being a colonial, you were accepted.
Oh yeah, well.
No problems.
No problems.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious too. How was it that, as a Canadian, you would wind up with, as you say, an RAF crew? How presumably you would think you would wind up with an RCAF bomber squadron?
Yes, that's quite true. But I think it was almost 1-4. You know, 4 times as many English as Canadians. And I think the decision was made that they should intermingle rather than have all Canadian
national units. Yeah. I know there was pressure for the creation of strictly Canadian units.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, they got Canadian squadrons, but I don't know whether they're all totally Canadians on it.
I gather the British High Command thought that was not necessarily a good idea to have. They would prefer to have mixed squadrons, presumably under British control.
But I think our crew was unique to an extent that we had 9 English and I was the only Canadian.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. By February 1944, you wind up at number 1657 Conversion Unit in Suffolk, England. Conversion unit, presumably meaning you are being converted literally from 2-engine to 4-engine planes.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. How did you find this adjustment?
Well, it didn't affect me too much, really, because I had nothing to do with the operation of the plane, just get it there and bring it back.
Right, right.
We were on the Stirlings at the time, and they're a very large aircraft, and you wonder how it would ever get off the ground.
Did you get a... perhaps a false sense of security being on a bigger plane?
Well, you always feel it. One engine goes, you got 3. You're on 2 engine, one goes, you're only on 1.
The equipment that you had to work with specifically in your position, how efficient was that, let's say?
Oh, it's quite good because it was on Stirlings and they were phasing them out from Bomber Command. So we had quite good ones. I don't recall any being unserviceable or, you know, flight canceled because the plane wasn't serviceable. Mm-hmm. So I'm not aware of that.
Would the whole crew, or would it be just strictly the pilot, be schooled in such things as aircraft recognition, silhouette?
No, we all had to do that, yes. Mm-hmm. Some were better than others, of course.
Sure. As part of your training, too, presumably because you're on a bomber unit, after all, which had a very high attrition rate, what your training, would that include such things as, in the event of being shot down, how to survive or how to escape?
Yes, we had courses on it, but I don't recall it, but we did. And we also had ditching.
Mm-hmm.
We went into the wash for that and watch some
parachute
out and get into dinghies. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any trepidation there with the parachute training at all, or was it just considered an extension?
Well, I didn't do any anyway. I think there were experienced ones.
Right.
And just give it a demonstration of it.
On the 16th of March, 1944, you go to number 214 Squadron, which was, one of the oldest RAF squadrons. in fact, part of number 100 group since the Great War in 1914. In effect, 214 was a special duty squadron comprising of American B-17 fortresses. By special duty, what was that? What did that imply?
Well, we had three extra crewmen that were familiar, were wireless operators, mm-hmm. and at least two of them were fluent in German. And it was just a case of monitoring the German instructions from the ground up to their pilots and the pilots down to the ground, bomber disposition, and we're basically to vector them in on us
as
the planes. So they intercept that message or jam it in any way mm-hmm. they felt there was our protection.
Mm-hmm. Was the German radars, were they efficient?
Well, we find out now more efficient than expected, and they also used our equipment as a homing device, mm-hmm. and they could pick it up the frequency and home right in
at a much greater range.
At a range, and just come in without your knowing, and there you are in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Operationally speaking, your first operation was the 16th of June, 1944. You go on this operation to the heart of the Ruhr Valley in Germany, and I guess not so strange that there were no encounters at that time with the German Air Force, because by this point, 1944, presumably the Luftwaffe is fairly spread out fairly thinly, what's left of it. And did that surprise you at all?
Well, I think it did, because we were not too happy in going to the Ruhr for our very first trip.
Sure.
And we had no evidence of any fighter activity at all. Mm-hmm. Saw the target and then came home and went over with in a good one.
I would think, due to the fact that you were bombing such a critical target, you and the fact you would expect at least to encounter some opposition, the fact that the longer you're into the mission and you don't, I guess the nerve-wracking aspect of it must get to you after a while.
Well, I would think offhand that the rest of the crew were more involved in it. I was just strictly doing my job, and I never did go out and mm-hmm. see a target, for example. Mm-hmm. So I was just made myself busy in that respect.
Now, I guess at this point we should clarify exactly what your job was, what you were doing.
Just navigating.
Navigating. Mm-hmm. So in a sense that might have worked to your advantage, because the fact you were concentrating so hard on that, you really didn't have time to be worrying about what was going on around you.
No. Mm-hmm. Where the others were, they could see. Mm-hmm. They could see the searchlights or maybe planes being shot down.
And you're aware of perhaps events, but really concentrating.
No, that's right.
Right. During such a mission, particularly one where you're not encountering opposition, is there much chatter between the crew members?
I even recall.
Mm-hmm. What about, and this is something that's interested me for quite a while, what about briefings and debriefings before and after missions? What sorts of things, particularly the debriefing aspect?
It was just a matter of them asking us questions, that I recall, of see any fighters, where, see any planes go down, mm-hmm. where did they go down, what height were you at, searchlights, which was to perhaps also to confirm what other crew had seen.
Right, to get general trends of what's going on.
If you saw it and nobody else saw it, why was only you?
Right.
And at what time it happened.
And I presume these briefings and debriefings would be conducted by what, RAF
intelligence
personnel?
Well, they weren't all RAF on the squadron. There was Canadians.
Sure.
A lot of Canadians on the squadron, mm-hmm. and a NAV officer was one, for example. Uh-huh. So, but they're all one unit.
Right.
You know, you're uh-huh. on a team, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Can you, getting back to just for a moment here, to the actual duties of the navigating officer, can you describe in layman's terms for the person listening who's not perhaps up on their navigation, exactly how you would go about, let's say, plotting a course from England to the Ruhr, or what steps do you take?
Well, the nav instructor, they give you course to take.
Mm-hmm.
You go, you, your landfalls and your time you're to be at there in the, when you alter course, the time and the course heading, and also the height up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And from there you just plot it on your chart.
And
you follow the headings. You have your compasses to give you the headings, and you instruct the the pilot what course to take. He, in a general term, knows what where you're going,
mm-hmm.
and so if any communication should go, he should have an idea where he is too.
Right, right. So a lot of it, of course, would be in those days flying low enough visual.
Yeah, that's right.
On the night of the 23rd, 24th of July, 1944, you are on a mission to the Kiel Canal,
mm-hmm.
which turned out to be not a very good trip, and I'm just wondering if you could tell us what happened here.
Well, that particular trip, we were coming down on target, and just as we were to alter course, I gave it to the pilot, and just that instant, we were hit by flak. And he was more interested in getting out of the danger of the flak by steep descent and ascent to alter the height for the Germans would have to do on their shells. That and with that sudden evasive action, everything in the aircraft more or less takes off.
Mm-hmm.
And we're holding on for dear life. And I wasn't aware that he didn't alter course for some period of time. And when I did find out, then it was a, although we were not being hit at that moment, I gave him a course that was approximate to get us out of there, out of land or onto the water as quickly as we could.
Mm-hmm. Out of the range of the flak.
Out of the range of the flak, and it was successful. And once we did that, we were no longer bothered, and it was a case of steering in the general direction of England that I figured would take us to England, and
mm-hmm.
it proved to be correct.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you'd have to be aware of wind speeds and all sorts of...
Yes, but luckily at that time, all the way, the winds were practically negligible. And every time we got a landfall and a fix, as it were, we were very close, if not on track, and
mm-hmm.
so it wasn't. Luckily, it wasn't a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we got over base, over the water, and getting closer to England, we got in range of the G, which is a navigational aid, and we were very close to where I thought we were.
Mm-hmm.
And so from then on, just follow it home. And
speaking of the winds and whatnot, yeah. I guess meteorology, you'd have to have some knowledge of
well,
what's going on there.
Well, yes, you, you do, but the nav officer told us
mm-hmm.
that the winds would not be a factor either going or coming.
Mm-hmm.
It's so one cancels out the other because there's always a little error in navigation, and it just seems to cancel out one another.
Mm-hmm. Almost exactly a month later, on the 25th and 26th of August, that night, August 1944, your aircraft and air crew are actually shot down, you believe, by a German Ju-88. And I'm wondering if you can describe the events leading up to the shooting down, the actual shooting down, because the sensation, once you realize that,
yeah.
I'm in trouble, we're in trouble, it must there must be a lot of thoughts
yeah.
running through your mind at that point.
Well, I recall that somebody said, no, the target was directly ahead, and then I don't know how long it was after that that heard the guns going,
uh-huh.
and didn't pay any attention because it didn't affect me particularly. And then I noticed that the altimeter in front of me, we were going down at a rapid pace. So I tried to contact the pilot, and no answer, and none from the crew. So I packed up my the oxygen and bottle and made my way to the up to the front to find out what's the trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilot says, bail out, we're on fire. And the starboard motor that I saw was on fire. So I just went back to the escape hatch, and there was two or three of the crew sitting there not knowing really what to do.
This would be in the belly of the plane.
In the belly, yes.
Right.
And the wireless operator got there about the same time as me and appraised the situation and said, well, follow me. So he went out and I went out, and I'm not sure of the others. Six of us survived and four were killed. And whether those four were the ones, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Bodies were found and identified. The fourth was not identified, so he might have been gone down with the plane and burnt beyond recognition.
Sure, sure.
His name is Runnymede.
Did your training, and I presume you did have some rudimentary training in bailing out procedures in the event of being shot down, did that training help you on your...
Well, knowing to put your parachute on and, mm-hmm. and pull the ripcord at the mm-hmm. appropriate time, mm-hmm. You're never given a dummy run, as it were, off a tower or anything like that, mm-hmm. no. The instincts come in and...
Were you afraid at this point?
No, I can't say that I was. Mm-hmm. I really... And on the way down, I just thought, well, I guess we'll see the end of the war. On ops, you never know from one op to another whether you're going to make it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was basically it, and how quiet it is drifting down.
So in a sense, you're almost relieved.
Relieved, I guess. You know, mm-hmm. you feel that you're going to make it all right.
You bailed out near Darmstadt in Germany, and I'm just wondering, first of all, how were you captured and who captured you?
Well, coming down, very quiet, and of course at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and the next thing I'm conscious of is trees. So I know I'm near the ground. And as soon as I hit the ground, I'm conscious of voices.
Mm-hmm.
And they must have seen me, and the only thing I could think of was Canada, Canada. And it must have been in somebody's, I feel, backyard, as it were, because they were there so quickly. And we were within walking distance of the local jail. And
now, who would these people, these be regular German army or civilians?
No, these were civilians, mm-hmm. yes. And I was an older man, which I would think was the, like, father. And I had hurt my back quite badly. Unable to, eventually, it was... fractured, yes. I found out it was fractured, and he had to help me up and kind of arms around me to help me to walk to the police station, and there we were interviewed, basically rank and all our valuables taken away from us. And
interviewed by whom?
I would think the head jailer or the chief of police.
So we're not talking Gestapo here?
No, not. You're just talking about ordinary, either civilians or police.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether I was the first or one or not, but anyway, four or five of us ended up in the same jail.
Mm-hmm. Were you taken there from
just
from
down below? Right. You know.
Were you taken as a group or individually?
No, individually. Mm-hmm. I just happened to notice my pilot come in.
Mm-hmm.
Why, I don't know. And we stayed there pretty well all day. And then we were interviewed. I don't recall much of the interview. And we were taken by lorry to a nearby air station for overnight and meals.
Mm-hmm.
I found the conditions there not too good. Our wireless operator had superficial wounds and lots of blood, and the flies seemed to attract them. One of the young girls happened to notice that my mid upper gunner's ankle was very bad, it was swollen, and she came and put cold water on it and did what she could. And
that's
I thought that was very, very thoughtful.
Almost surprising, given the fact that some of the stories I've heard of how the Germans, once they got their hands on bomber crews, because after all, yeah. it was the bomber crews.
Yeah.
Wreaking yeah. the devastation on yeah. their country, yeah. that in many cases they weren't so kind to the bomber.
That's what we heard, and I guess it was very true, and I think it would happen to most of us. But I think this was in a small little town. That's
mm-hmm.
what I feel, and the war never touched them except for the privations. I don't think they were ever bombed. Certainly at night when they're walking you don't see any anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think humans, you know, if you're injured, not going to take advantage of you. I mm-hmm. just feel that.
So in a sense, it might be fair to say that you were captured by Germans rather than Nazis.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you are taken to Frankfurt by train, presumably, and ultimately from there to an interrogation, an official interrogation center run by the Luftwaffe. I'm told and I've heard that treatment at the hands of the Luftwaffe officials was much preferred to SS or regular army.
Oh yes.
How did they treat you as almost comrade, knights of the air type sort of thing?
No, they ask you questions and answer them. It's just military. The interrogator knows more about you than you know about yourself. Mm-hmm. It seems, from my experience and others, they seem to know everything. You know who your station commander is and the planes you're flying, what you're doing. Didn't seem to be anything you didn't know. That
mm-hmm. And there was ever any hint of physically trying to extract
information. No, all they're looking for is confirmation, and not letting you just have it easy.
No.
You know, difficult. I guess you give them a difficult time, they'll do it to you.
Mm-hmm. You were transferred from the interrogation center again by train to a POW camp on Labor Day 1944, which I guess is somewhat appropriate. The camp being at Kreuzberg. Again, presumably a camp run by the Luftwaffe. This would be Stellag.
Left 7,
okay. What were the camp conditions there like? How did were you prepared in your mind for what you were?
Not really, no. Because you never talked to anybody that had been in one, so mm-hmm. you don't know what to expect. But when we got there, the boys were happy, looked well fed, athletic, well tanned. They'd been there all summer.
All airmen, of course.
All airmen. They're not required to do any work.
Being officers,
NCOs, mm-hmm. and so they lived in that respect a good life. The food was a problem, but at that particular time, they got one Red Cross parcel a week. Mm-hmm. And the day we arrived, they were notified there was one every 2 weeks, and so that would. So all my experience, we were always short of food.
Mm-hmm. I was under the impression that those parcels were of a sort of a uniform nature, but I understand there were American and British and Canadian parcels, and which each one sort of varied as to the quality.
Yeah, and varied. Not the quality as much as the selection. Mm-hmm. Like the Americans gave you chocolate bars, which you didn't get in the English. The English gave you rolled oats or porridge.